It's Monday, June 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, South Carolina's governor calls for a controversial flag to be removed from state buildings after a white supremacist loyal to that flag allegedly shot and killed 9 black people at a local church. We'll hear from VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone about the debate within the United States over the Confederate flag and how Republican presidential candidates are dealing with it.
They're being very careful. They say it's up to the people of South Carolina because many of the supporters of the flag see it as a states' rights issue.
That story and more coming up on International Edition. Well, as we've been reporting, South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley announced today that she wants her state to remove the Confederate flag from state buildings. There have been growing calls within the U.S. for that flag to come down after photos emerged showing Dylan Roof, the alleged shooter behind last week's massacre of 9 black worshippers at a South Carolina church, posing with that flag. Before Haley's announcement, I sat down with VOA reporter Amanda Scott, who's just returned to Washington from a 3-day visit to Charleston, South Carolina, where the shooting happened last Wednesday. I asked Amanda how the community has been coping with the tragedy.
Well, I'd say for the most part, you know, there's a large sense of grief in the community, but there's also a sense of resolve. Like, people are coming to accept what's happened, but they are resolved to not let it tear their city apart, to not let it, you know, diminish the respect that they have for each other, and to take this as a lesson as to, I guess, the dangers of racism and the brutality that it can still inflict on people today.
So what kind of conversations did you get into with the folks in Charleston about the shooting? What were some of the main themes of what they were telling you, and what did you think about them?
I think for many people, you know, the shooting was a reminder of, you know, some of the challenges the black churches faced, you know, in the earlier parts of last century. Like in the 1960s, you know, black churches across the southern part of the United States were bombed. They were attacked at points. They had to be guarded by police. So for, you know, this congregation in particular, where you do have a lot of older members, you know, they didn't necessarily have to say it. The preacher did mention it a bit at some point, but it was a reminder to a more brutal chapter in U.S. history.
Well, we've had some other reminders of America's history with racism and slavery, even with the issue of the Confederate flag. There's been a huge debate generated in South Carolina and nationally as to whether that flag should continue to fly outside government buildings in South Carolina. So I'd like to get an idea from you about what people are saying in South Carolina about the flag.
Well, the issue of the Confederate flag in the South is something, you know, of intense, heated discussions and debates that have been going on for decades. I think for the most part, the African-American community sees the flag as a symbol of, you know, this brutal, racist past. But on the other hand, many Southerners see it as a symbol of their Southern pride. You know, when right now the flag does fly on South Carolina state buildings. After this attack, when the U.S. flag was flown at half-mast, the Southern Confederate flag was still flown at full height. And I really think that hit home for a lot of people and really, you know, kind of reignited this issue. There were marches against it. But overall, during my time in South Carolina, in Charleston in particular, you don't see it outside of a lot of buildings. But I know if you venture a bit outside the city, you know, there are people that proudly display the flags outside of their homes, on their cars. You know, they wear shirts. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's still, there's a certain sting when you see it displayed so outwardly.
And that was VOA's Amanda Scott speaking with me earlier, again, ahead of that announcement by South Carolina's governor that she wants the Confederate flag to be taken down. Well, the issue of the flag is starting to become a major one in U.S. presidential politics. Earlier, my colleague Susan Yaki spoke to our national correspondent Jim Malone to find out what the candidates have been saying about the flag controversy.
What about the Democrats? Have they said much about
this? Well, Hillary Clinton, back to 2007, said that the flag should be removed. Even Mitt Romney, the Republican presidential nominee in 2012, tweeted over this past weekend that the flag should be taken away. Jeb Bush, the former Florida governor, said when he was governor, he had it relegated to a museum in Florida, and he would like to see the same thing done in South Carolina. But again, they're being very careful. They say it's up to the people of South Carolina, because many of the supporters of the flag see it as a state's rights issue, that the federal government should not be telling the state what to do.
Well, the murder of the 9 African Americans and on recent police activities, there have been several shootings of people by police, African Americans, and that's caused riots and more. Well, this has all put a big spotlight on race relations in the United States.
It has, and even President Barack Obama's weighed in on this, saying, obviously there are signs that racism continues to exist in the country. It's something we have to grapple with. Mr. Obama was elected in 2008. Some people hailed that as the first step in a post-racial America where race would not matter as much. And while there are certainly improvements that a lot of people can agree on, there's still a long way to go. And the incidents we've seen over the past year and a half or so involving police treatment of African Americans continues to resonate around the country. And it shows that these issues, they may be tamped down for a time, but they're always just under the radar and ready to pop up again here in the United States.
I think a lot of people saw the election of an African American President Obama as a turning point, maybe. The race issue was behind us, and now America is multi-ethnic, and there's race issue is gone. And they were surprised all this is coming up.
Well, one way the president likes to look at it is he talks about we're an imperfect union. We're an imperfect country. The point is we keep trying to get better. And certainly his election in 2008 was a sign people were willing to accept a minority president. But does it remove all ills? Does it cure all the problems of our society? No. And the recent tragic events in Charleston show that we still have a ways to go.
Sometimes presidential candidates like to get into these hot topics early on in the campaigning so that by the time we get near the elections, the subject has died away a bit. Do you think that might be the case here? It's too hot for near the elections?
It's too hot because a lot of them are afraid of offending, I think, conservative voters who are watching them very closely on this. Even former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee said he doesn't see why it should be discussed by presidential contenders. Well, he's going to get some debate on that, especially on the Democrats. Side. So for now, they're keeping it low key. I have a feeling the pressure will mount and many of them will start to speak up more in the days ahead.
A discussion on whether they should discuss it or act on it, I guess, huh?
Welcome to the State of Our Politics 2015.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim, for stopping by.
Thank you.
And that was International Edition's Susan Yaki speaking with our national correspondent, Jim Malone. Well, Andrew Palchevsky is here now to give us an update on how social media are reacting to the latest developments in the South Carolina shooting. Andrew, what do you have for us?
Well, the big news today is an interview that President Obama gave with Mark Maron. He went on his show, his podcast, and President Obama used the N-word, which is a racial slur here in the U.S., to describe how the racism in the U.S. persists and we are not cured of that racism. And in fact, rather than the actual term trending on Twitter, it was N-word that was the trending topic. People taking to Twitter and saying this was very brave of President Obama to use this word to highlight that racism persists. Other people saying that it was offensive. Many people find that word offensive still to this day. But using that word has caused a lot of conversation on social media.
And are people actually spelling out the word as well, or they're just using
some
the
people,
N-word?
Some people do, but the one that's trending is N-word.
Yeah. Right. What else are people saying about South Carolina on social media?
Well, it's been a developing story since the shooting last Wednesday, and now people are looking at the victims and the killer and looking at what do we call this. A lot of people saying this is a hate crime because it was racially based, people calling it domestic terrorism. Other people are saying that guns are to blame, that racial attitudes in the country are to blame, and people even saying mental illness. So we have a lot of different opinions that people are taking to social media to share about why this unfortunate, horrible incident occurred. The interesting thing, and we're going to be talking about this on the show #VOA tomorrow, is that it's not mutually exclusive. Mental illness, race, guns, those are all contributing factors. So we're going to be talking about that on #VOA. We invite all of you to join us tomorrow on voanews.com. It's 1730 UTC, 1:30 p.m. Eastern Time here in the U.S., again on voanews.com.
And we'll be watching that show tomorrow. You can stream it live on our homepage. Thanks, Andrew. This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Drought, record flooding, and deadly heat waves. A recent study in the journal Nature Climate Change says extreme weather is becoming more frequent and links it to a rise in greenhouse gas emissions. The report says such weather events have more than doubled in the past three decades. Harold Brooks is with the National Weather Center.
The heat wave, particularly the one in Europe in the early 2000s and the one in Russia a couple of years ago, almost certainly had their probabilities increased dramatically because of greenhouse gas emissions.
Brooks says, however, the world will continue to experience extreme weather no matter what happens with greenhouse gas emissions.
The really interesting question is, what we try to actually answer is, has the increase in greenhouse gases changed the probability of an event occurring?
Brooks says, in general, weather watchers expect to see an increase in both floods and droughts associated with greenhouse gas emissions. I'm VOA's Rebecca Ward for Greenbeat.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. It's time now for a look at the latest business news with our New York correspondent, Alexis Christophorus. A short while ago, I spoke to Alexis about reports that Greece has a new proposal to get itself out of a debt crisis with its European Union creditors. I asked her what is in that proposal.
Well, Michael, the news is certainly encouraging. A Eurozone finance minister, after concluding an emergency meeting today where they discussed this latest proposal from Greece to solve its debt problems, said this was very encouraging. It is a major move in the right direction for Greece. And while there is no agreement just yet, he says a deal later in the week is certainly possible. And the big concession here is that this newest proposal allows for major deficit cutting in Greece's pension system. And we know this has been a huge sore spot for the people in Greece. They believe that austerity has already been quite onerous for them, especially in the area of pensions. But this new government has come out and said, we are willing to make even more concessions in this area, much to the chagrin of the Greeks, and they foresee new pension savings and revenues worth 0.4% of gross domestic product for this year and 1% starting next year. So that would bring the left-wing government close to the target demanded by its creditors. And if the government's calculations are confirmed by Greece's creditors, which are the International Monetary Fund, the European Central Bank, the Eurozone governments, it could be a big step toward ending a four-month deadlock that has prompted warnings of a Greek exit, as we know, from the Eurozone. So this is definitely promising news, and hopes that there could be a deal later in the week is really what buttressed global stock markets. We saw the NASDAQ hit a record high, and the Dow was up by triple digits.
Thanks, Alexis. So I understand you also have some news for us about a Chinese insurance company and an online insurance company that is attracting attention from overseas investors. What more can you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is exciting news for this company. The name of the company is Zhongan Online P&C Insurance. And what's special about this company is they are the first online-only insurance company in China, and they just received a major confidence boost and cash infusion from a consortium of investors led by Morgan Stanley. They are investing $934 million in this online Chinese insurance company. The company, we should mention, is also backed by Alibaba's financial services unit. And get this, Michael, the deal values this two-year-old Chinese online insurer at $8 billion. So quite a good day for the folks who've invested in Zhongan Online.
And that was our New York business correspondent, Alexis Christophorus. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe marked 50 years of diplomatic relations with South Korea on Monday by meeting with visiting South Korean Foreign Minister Yun Byung-se. Mr. Abe and Yun pledged to improve ties that have been strained by Japan's colonial past. That past has produced a legacy of maritime territorial disputes and bad feelings in South Korea about Japan's imposition of sexual slavery on tens of thousands of South Korean women. Victor Beatty spoke earlier to Stephen Norper, vice president of the New York-based Korea Society, and asked him about the significance of Japan and South Korea celebrating their half-century of relations.
Well, the anniversary is actually very important in the sense that it reminds us that these two were able to overcome tremendous political obstacles to reach normalization at a period that, you know, was only 20 years past the end of World War II, when memories of colonial occupation and a wartime Japan were fresh in Korean minds. Yet they overcame that for the benefit of both nations, and both Japan and Korea have been models for democracy, for economic liberalization. They've had both incredibly successful economies that have made a real difference in the region, and they've both had increasing regional and global leadership roles as a result. So the fact that they are marking 50 years of that anniversary is important, and it's a reminder that perhaps the current troubles, the current impasses are not as significant as they might have seemed at first dealing in the last few years, but that the tried test of time is that the two are important to one another, and that prosperity for the Northeast Asia region really lies with Japan and Korea cooperating fully with one another.
Well, the two leaders of both countries are going to be taking part in separate ceremonies in their respective capitals. They have not met since they each took office.
But it is an important first step because they are making the commitment to visit the official proceedings that mark the normalization of relations. They could have easily sent a message. That's what was expected. But the fact that they're extending a physical gesture by way of their attendance implies that the likely meeting between now and December, when the trilateral takes place, is very important. And it shows that at least there's an easing, however slight, on the part of both leaders to try to reach a political accommodation, which is very important at this time.
And that was analyst Stephen Norper of the Korea Society speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute. Pope Francis recently issued an urgent warning and challenge to the people of the world to recognize and take action against the harm the pontiff says humans are inflicting on the earth. Environmentalists welcome the Pope's letter or encyclical, one of the highest-ranking documents a pope can release. Climatologist Ray Bradley from the University of Massachusetts.
The issue of global warming and environmental degradation has become so political that it's really great to have somebody who has no political agenda speak on the topic.
Some climate change skeptics were not moved by the Pope's writings. James Taylor is with the Heartland Institute.
I fear that the Pope is getting poor advice. I believe that these actions to address global warming are unnecessary and counterproductive.
Pope Francis and his encyclical on climate change has been hailed as a major intervention in the climate change debate. I'm Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. In today's look at the music world, VOA's David Byrd takes a look at Kelly Clarkson's latest single with Larry London.
She won the very first American Idol, and now Kelly Clarkson has a new song that's climbing the charts. It's called Invincible. It's from her new CD, Piece by Piece, and Larry London joins me to talk about this tune. Larry,
well,
this is another anthem from Kelly Clarkson, I guess.
She's very good at creating music that people can relate to and connect with, and that's one of the keys to her success over the years. And the new album is great, Piece by Piece. She took an off-road for a little bit, did some country music, but she's kind of back in the main lane of the pop world and just finished off with a Heartbeat song, which was her 16th Top 40 single. And so the new song, Invincible, as you mentioned, It's an inspirational song. It's a very happy, positive song. And Kelly's in a very positive place right now, despite all of the criticism that she's been undergoing recently because of her weight gain. And so she's okay. She's happy with herself. She says, I love myself, and I am invincible, which is what this song kind of reflects and represents.
You know I was broke down. I hit the ground. I was crying now. I couldn't make no sound. No one hears the silent tears. You know I had lost hope, I was all alone, never been so low, till you came along, teacher,
Now, she had a baby, right? That's why she had some weight gain.
Well, she's always battled weight. That's been a problem that she's dealt with her entire life. She admits openly that the weight issues have always been troublesome for her. She did drop a few pounds a number of years ago, but since the baby, since the birth of River Rose, it has not been a very easy thing for her to get rid of the weight. But she's happy with herself, as she said. In fact, she said after she finishes her current tour, she's going to try and get pregnant again. She wants to have another baby by the end of this year. She wants to be pregnant.
And this song talks about, you know, issues like overcoming abuse. The video for it has different women in different scenarios. One woman is in a wheelchair. One woman is like in an abusive situation, you know, and it's different ethnicities, different races, et cetera. And is Kelly trying to broaden her appeal with the video, or what exactly is she doing there?
Well, that's an interesting question, David. Kelly, you know, currently appeals to quite a diverse group of people to begin with. They all like her and relate to her. She's a person who's overcome a number of obstacles, as we mentioned a little while ago. She grew up in a very small town in Texas, and they weren't very wealthy. Mom was an English teacher. And so, you know, she's considers herself to be the average kind of person. She doesn't look at herself as a star. She thinks her music is very relatable, and she's very reachable. She's very reachable. She's not kind of up on a perch or anything like that. She wants to be an everybody's person, and I think she comes across that way. You really like Kelly. She's genuine with everything she does. 25 million sales. She's won so many awards, including 12 Billboard Music Awards. So, you know, she's got the appeal that is necessary to make it in the music business these days. And the new song is doing very well. She performed it for the first time on television at the Billboard Award Show.
All right. That's VOA's Larry London. We'd love to hear what you think about this. You can go on to our Facebook page. That's VOA Music. It's facebook.com/VOA-music. You can leave your comments there. Larry also hosts VOA's Border Crossings, which has its own Facebook page. You can contact him there. Maybe he'll play Kelly Clarkson's Invincible.
Love to do it.
And that's a wrap of International Edition on The Voice of America. Your director today was Tracy Carter. The engineer was Zahara Abu Zaid. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm at Michael_Lippin, spelled L-I-P-I-N. Have a great week.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is deeply concerned by the June 16th conviction and sentencing by a Bahraini court of Sheikh Ali Salman, the Secretary General of the Al-Wafaq Opposition Political Society. He was convicted of inciting hatred, promoting disobedience, and insulting public institutions. Sheikh Ali is also a Shia Muslim cleric. Sheikh Ali was jailed in December after he delivered a series of speeches calling for political reform and accountability after his re-election as party leader. His arrest triggered protests across the country. In 2011, at the time of the Arab Spring, dozens died when the government of Bahrain moved to quash protests demanding more rights and an end to discrimination against the majority Shia community by the Sunni royal family. Bahrain has dealt with sporadic unrest since then. The United States has consistently said opposition parties that peacefully voice criticism of the government play a vital role in inclusive, pluralistic states and societies. Creating an atmosphere in which a full range of political opinions can be peacefully expressed is essential in Bahrain, across the Middle East, and globally. Furthermore, this action by the Bahraini court has the potential to further inflame tensions. Amnesty International said Sheikh Ali's conviction was another clear example of Bahrain's flagrant disregard for international obligations and called for his immediate release. The United States believes that no one, anywhere, should be prosecuted or imprisoned for engaging in peaceful expression or assembly. Any charges against Sheikh Ali that were brought on that basis should be dropped. The U.S. also strongly urges the government of Bahrain to abide by its commitment to the protection of freedom of expression.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.